In 2012, German-American journalist Michael Scott Moore traveled to Somalia to investigate the reality of modern piracy. Shortly into his trip, he got closer to the issue than he ever intended, as he was kidnapped and held hostage by pirates for more than 2 years. In his new book, The Desert and the Sea, 977 Days Captive on a Somali Pirate Coast, Michael Scott Moore recounts his harrowing tale as his struggle to survive both his physical and psychological injuries. It's published by Harper Wave, and I'm glad it's brought Michael Scott Moore to the show. Michael, welcome.
Great to be here.
So first off, I want to ask, how did you even get interested in Somali piracy?
Well, piracy was interesting in itself because all of a sudden it was there again. You know, we had gone through at least two centuries of relatively no piracy.
I remember when the story first surfaced that I was hearing comedians make jokes about, oh, we're supposed to solve the problems of the 17th and the 21st century.
That's right.
It came out of nowhere, or did it?
Well, it seemed to come out of nowhere, but no, there had been a lot going on off the Somali coast for a while, and it came out of a problem in Somalia. First of all, it came from the fact that that Somalia had no national government anymore, so it couldn't defend its coastlines. And because of that, there was a lot of illegal fishing that went on that was actually taking fish away from Somalis. So those are the roots of it. And in the 90s, you already had some local defense of fish stocks by sort of local warlords that would send out little boats of gunmen. And they would hold ships for, 48 hours for about $50,000 or something like that, and call that, okay, that's a license to fish from us, and that's how things worked off Somalia for most of the 90s, or at least off Puntland. And it was in Puntland that it actually became a bigger deal and departed from the fishing problem in about 2005. And that's when we started to hear about it.
Okay. And that's the piracy where people are, boarding ships, et cetera, and taking people hostage.
That's right. They would actually take big ships, like cargo ships, and hold them for millions of dollars. And then, by then it had nothing to do with fishing. And by the time they took journalists like me, then it really had nothing to do with fishing.
So you had, as I understand from the book, this came onto your radar because of a case that was going on in Germany, and even the German press was fascinated by the fact that there were pirates in a courtroom.
Yeah, that's right. I was working for Spiegel Online at the time in Berlin, and there was a trial of 10 pirates in Hamburg. That was the first trial of pirates on German soil in 400 years. So the revival of piracy in the world was interesting to me. And in fact, five of these 10 guys came from a specific town in central Somalia, and I found connections to go there. And that was the original point of the trip.
So when you actually went to travel to Somalia, first off, looking back on it, do you feel as though you were fully prepared, or did you go into it perhaps a little naive, not really knowing what to expect?
I knew the dangers, and I went with a more experienced journalist named Ashwin Rahman. He's a war zone journalist for German television. I can't say that I'm glad I did it, but I went in there knowing what the risks were.
Well, reading your book, it reads sort of like a long-form diary entry, and you get very crystal clear about feelings and sights and smells. They're all very palpable. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you could recount for us what your experience of the actual kidnapping was.
Well, that was obviously harrowing. I mean, I was driving back from the airport at that point. It was 10 days into our trip, and Ashwin had just flown off for Mogadishu, actually. So we had seen him off at the airport, and we came back into town in a car. And waiting for our car was a battle wagon, it's called a technical, but it's a flatbed truck with a cannon in the back. And there were about 12 guys, 10 or 15 guys with Kalashnikovs waiting for us. And they aimed the cannon right through our windshield, and my guards did nothing. So they were overpowered. And the 10 or 12 guys came over to my side of the car and dragged me out. They beat me with their guns. They bloodied my head. They broke my wrist. They broke my glasses. And they piled me into a waiting car. And then off we drove into the bush. And then I was captive for the next 2.5 years.
And what were the conditions that you were held under like?
Miserable. Dirty most of the time. I was held in the bush for the first few months and also kind of indoors sometimes. But then they put me on a ship. The same pirate gang had actually caught a tuna vessel a little bit after they captured me. And they anchored it off Hobyo. And they brought me and one other journalist, one other hostage, actually a fisherman from the Seychelles, a wonderful guy named Rolly. They put the two of us on board the ship, probably to save money, so they didn't have to have two separate guard teams. And I spent 5 or 6 months on that ship. And that was an unusual part of my captivity, because I don't think any other Western writer has spent time on a ship captured by Somali pirates. That was a Southeast Asian ship, a Taiwanese, East Asian ship with a lot of Southeast Asian sailors. There were a total of 30 hostages on board, 28 crew and the two of us. And then after that, I was held alone in prison houses around Galkayo. So there was a variety of experiences. And actually the ship, which was frightening when I first boarded it, I had no idea what was going on at night, you know, turned out to be the easiest part of the experience because the food was not bad.
Well, yeah, and that's actually interesting, is that there's a part where you sort of talk about the spaghetti meals.
Yeah, those were on land. They were miserable.
Yeah.
The pirates would actually serve us cooked spaghetti with not very much on it out of plastic bags, basically shopping bags or garbage bags. And we would have to eat that with forks, you know, one bag for the two of us, me and Rolly, and we would eat one bite at a time, and that was our dinner.
And through that process of just eating, spaghetti with, like, essentially nothing on it, as you said.
Boiled potato, or maybe.
You shed a lot of weight.
Yeah, 40 pounds at first. Within the first several months, I mean, by the time I was on the ship, I had lost 40 pounds, and that took about 3 months.
So the other thing that I thought was interesting was that the spaghetti meals, oddly enough, made you think of Somalia's colonialist past.
That's right. Well, I mean, I noticed that Somalis liked spaghetti even before I was captured. So when I was traveling around in central Somalia and we had meals together, sometimes it was spaghetti. And I mentioned that to my fixer. I said, is this a holdover from the time Italy, you know, was running part of Somalia as a colony? And he said, yeah, it was the best thing they left behind.
Well, no, because the reason why I wanted to get into that is because there's so many lingering problems that a lot of countries in Africa are struggling with. And a lot of experts have pointed to the colonialist history that's, you know, caused some of these scars. I'm wondering, how do you see that playing into what was left of Somalia that allowed these pirates to sort of take over and run at least the waterways?
Well, I think there's no question that Italy and as well as Britain ran Somalia. They ran two sections of Somalia during the colonial era as plantations. So they took the stuff that they wanted Somalis to grow and slaughter. So there's a lot of cattle in Somalia. The holdover is that Somalis, for a while, they were running their own country very well, but they never learned to do it really effectively without a strong man leader. And some people say that it was the colonialists who actually introduced corruption to Somalia. So that's a problem. This is a lingering hangover from colonialism. It's not the whole story. But the problems with Somalia now are directly related to the fact that the last strongman president toppled in 91, and they just haven't gotten it together in the meantime. That's a problem among the clans within Somalia. But absolutely, I mean, colonialism was not a good thing for the entire Horn of Africa.
So with so many different pirates that sort of sprung up and, I guess, took advantage of an opportunity, were the pirates who were in charge of you, were they different than some of the other groups? Were they more brutal? Were they kinder? What kind of relationship did you have with them?
That depends on which phase you're talking about. But I'd say for the first few weeks, I was held by pirates who were not very nice. The guys that captured me were also the guys that guarded us in those first few weeks. Then it changed. I moved to a group that seemed to go a little easier on me. They were all still pirates, but they sometimes claimed not to be, you know. On the ship, it was a slightly different group. You know, it went up and down. Mm-hmm. And when I was held alone towards the end, actually for the last 2 years, I would say about half the guard team had the capacity to be nice to me. The other half just really didn't care. You know, when I tried to speak Somali to them, they didn't even want to hear it. The other half, you know, we could we could speak a little bit, and we built up a rapport.
So for the captors who were willing to speak to you, mm-hmm. how did they justify what they were doing?
Well, that was very interesting. I didn't expect to see so many of my guards pray. Before I went to Somalia, I assumed most pirates were irreligious, and Somalia is a Muslim nation, but I didn't think that most pirates could even justify to themselves being religious. Most of my guards prayed five times a day, and I found that really interesting because most Somalis are Sufi, and we have an impression of Sufism as a very generous and open sort of tradition of Islam. These guys justified holding me when I asked them about it. I was very pointed about asking them, one of them. They justified holding me by saying I was an infidel, and that stealing from an infidel wasn't theft. And I thought that was a very unique interpretation of Islam.
Did your status as an American also add to that?
Almost certainly. I mean, they just assume Westerners in general are rich, and so they assumed that they were going to get lots of money from me just because I was an American.
Well, throughout your captivity, and you mentioned so yourself that you were frequently moved around a lot, and
yeah.
I'm wondering if that was intentional to help create a sense of confusion or chaos for yourself. Were there points when you were clear or had a vague idea maybe on where you were?
Sure. Oh, sometimes yes. Sometimes obviously no. But I don't think they were trying to confuse me because they didn't move other hostages around quite so much. So in other words, when I was suddenly a hostage, the pirates found themselves the very interested subject of curiosity by surveillance planes. So there were drones and planes going overhead, and as a result, they moved me around a little more often than they would have moved other hostages around. Rolly, who I was suddenly thrown together with, said, "I've never moved around this much since I got captured. It's because of you."
So I guess then, in a weird way, it was good to be sort of attached to you.
You never know. It was inconvenient. It was not nice to be moved around, especially at night. On the other hand, there was a chance we'd both get rescued.
Ah. Well, so this is also something that I thought was so interesting. Communication with your family members. Mm-hmm. Were you able to have any kind of communication?
Yeah. They put me on the phone with my mother after the first week. And every month or so, I got on the phone again. They expected me to yell bloody murder and demand the $20 million that they were demanding and that sort of thing. I did nothing of the kind. But until about a year in, I had regular phone calls with my family.
And at one point, I mean, you describe a story about how your mother even suggested something along the lines of a care package or something.
Yeah.
Which, okay, I realize that sounds really... not quite away at camp, but still though, the fact that there was a possibility of something getting through to you,
yeah.
Was that a real possibility or was that just trying to reach out and say something comforting?
I think it was just trying to find a way. I think it was more realistic from her point of view than it seemed from mine. You know, when she mentioned it on the phone, I actually started to cry. I mean, that was one point where I kind of lost it because, it struck me that she didn't know how many layers of people and groups a care package would have to reach to get to, at that point, the ship where I was being held. So it struck me that she didn't quite realize how chaotic it was. But actually, she had pretty good advice, and she found ways to contact NGOs who made it sound not quite impossible. It never happened, but she did want to see if I could get a pair of glasses or something through these, through various groups that could get close to the pirates.
Did you have any fantasies or hopes of escape?
Always.
Always. What did you learn about the people who were your captives? You mentioned the fact that some of them were a lot harsher and crueler as opposed to others who were perhaps a little bit more tolerant, mm-hmm. I should say. For the people who are willing to talk to you, did they give you any indication as to why you were taken?
I think in the end, just for money. I don't think there was anything else going on. There were some rumors at the beginning that I was a spy, you know, but those are the things that, criminal gangs tell themselves to justify what they do. So there was that, but I don't think there was anything else in the boss's minds except money.
So was there any concern for your physical and mental well-being, or?
Oh, I think so. I mean, from my point of view, yeah. I mean, I was beaten at the beginning. I was beaten at random during the whole ordeal, not systematically. But there was always a chance I would just get shot accidentally or something. You know, that happened. In fact, when we boarded the ship, the first thing we learned was that the captain had been shot when the pirates boarded. Not on purpose. They just sprayed the bridge with bullets. And the captain was the one who got it. That stuff just happens. Other hostages, I knew stories, you know, other hostages had died of disease because they couldn't get the right medicines. I wound up with malaria, and they did give me the right medicines after a while, but I know for a fact that two of the men on the ship in the crew had died in the meantime of various diseases, which meant that they did not give those guys the right medicines.
I'm speaking with Michael Scott Moore, the author of the new memoir, The Desert and the Sea, about being held captive for 2 years by Somali pirates. So you mentioned a little bit earlier the fact that you were sort of taken aback that so many of your captors prayed five times a day as devout Muslims. And I'm wondering, how did they, for people who weren't Muslims, were they hostile towards you or towards anyone else? How was that handled?
Yeah, I think they were hostile towards everyone, but they had that justification. So in other words, not only were they devout, but they were also, especially the low-ranking guards, you know, fairly ignorant. So I think the bosses spread the rumor among the guards that most of these hostages they had to take care of were pig eaters. And that came up more than once, you know. We were eating pork on the ship, or when we drove through the bush and a wild pig ran away from the car, they would say, "Michael, you know, pig," as if I would want to go out there and eat one. And that was, I think, a deliberate tactic by the bosses to dehumanize us. Did it help when they actually had Muslim hostages? Actually, not very much. There were four guys on board the ship, and I said, "Well, have you gotten special treatment because you're a Muslim?" And they're like, "No." So one thing Boshko said, one of the guards I talked to, he said, "Actually, with those guys, we have to make an exception. We're not going to take any ransom money from their families." So that was his scruple about that. But he was not a very high-ranking guard, and the bosses were certainly not Muslim. They were not religious. So whether the bosses cared about that stuff or not, I suspect they didn't. The one difference in treatment that the four Muslims got was they got a little extra food at the end of the day during Ramadan. You know, they were fasting as well as the guards, and then the guards had a big feast upstairs, and they would bring some rice down for the four Muslim guys.
You tell a story also when you were on the fishing boat about Rollo, I believe.
Raleigh.
Yeah, Raleigh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how he was reading a Bible. He had a Bible with him. Mm-hmm. And one of the guards had a very hostile reaction to just seeing the Bible.
Yep. He didn't like the sight of it, and he didn't even want to touch it. So he leaned back and kicked it with his foot. And that really upset Rolly. And that's how I opened the book, because it was surprising to see that kind of reaction. The head of the ship, the head of the guard team on the ship, the main pirate, actually punished that guy for doing that. So there was retribution, and there was a certain amount of justice.
Well, also at one point throughout your captivity, you yourself were given a Bible. How did that come about, considering that situation that had happened with Raleigh?
Well, five of the guys on the ship, five of the hostage crew were Filipino. The others were from Cambodia and Vietnam and so on. The five Filipinos were Christian, and they happened to have a couple of Bibles, and so they gave it to us as reading material. And it was the first time I'd had anything to read in 3-4 months, you know, when we got on the ship. So I read the Bible twice while I was on board.
Wow. One of the more unique anecdotes that stood out to me was at one point you were trying to teach some of the pirates yoga. How did that just And again, I'm sure that this was an incredibly extreme, difficult situation under which it happened. But reading it in my very comfortable American life, I was like, of course the American would want to teach them yoga.
Well, it was one way I survived. So once I got dragged back onto land after the ship, I was held in a sort of concrete cell, and I noticed there was room in the cell for a mat, and they weren't going to let me jog. Sometimes you hear stories of prisoners being able to jog around the room or whatever. If I had done that, they would have shot me. So I asked for a mat, and they brought me one a few days later, and I started to do yoga. And of course, they found it funny at first, but the guards were locked into that prison house just like I was. Someone else had keys. So they couldn't come and go as they wanted. And they were aware of getting weak and not getting any exercise, too. So they started to do yoga with me. They came in with their own sort of cardboard flats for yoga mats on the dirty floor. And they imitated my postures. And I eventually started to give them, you know, tips. So I may be the only Westerner who's taught yoga to Somali pirates.
But as random as that story sounds, it seems like it's one of those incredibly important moments of shared humanity to make this survivable for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the guys who imitated me and weren't fully joking about it and who kept doing it for the next few weeks, they were the ones I got along with. You know, they were the ones that I could talk to in some way. We could mix a little bit of English and Somali together and we could have a conversation. So that was very important.
Did you ever feel well, I'm sure you must have reached breaking points where you found yourself actually responding back to your captors in a way that you were being treated, i.e. yelling back at them or allowing that rage to come to the forefront?
Yeah, I mean, the first rule was not to let it come to the forefront because I was angry all the time. And if I had acted as angry as I felt all the time, I would have been in trouble. But every now and then, you know, at one point they had a TV in the house and they let me watch it and then they took it and they watched it out on the porch and then it was loud and I was annoyed because I didn't even have my thoughts to myself, you know. And so I would yell at them about the TV and then they would yell back and we had arguments about several things.
Wow. Also, I wanted to circle back, sorry, about the pirates and the fact that part of their behavior could be related to the fact that they were constantly chewing on this leaf that I understand that it's supposed to be sort of like constantly maybe drinking alcohol in America.
Yeah, it's called cut. And it's really common in that part of the world, not just in Somalia, but also in Yemen. The Somalis called it the Somali beer. But it's basically one thing that Muslims can do to get high that isn't prescribed in the Quran. So they're not allowed to drink alcohol, so they chew cut. Absolutely every pirate I met was addicted to cut. And the guards that I was held by would sit in front of a pile of it for hours every afternoon and just get really high. And by the evening, they would be sort of excitable. At nighttime, they would pass out, and in the morning, they'd wake up depressed. And that was the cycle. So they kept pushing it on me. They wanted me to try cut, and I tried a few stems every now and then. And sure enough, it changed your mood. I mean, it actually turned you from a depressed person into a fairly, you know, up person. But I didn't want to get addicted the way they did because the effects were pretty brutal.
Wow. Do you know what became of your captors? I mean, once that you were able to get free, and we should talk about that specific situation, but just out of curiosity, do you know what became of any of these people?
No, not necessarily. There was a ransom paid, so I know that each of them got paid off, probably to the tune of $10,000 each or something like that. They probably took that money and went off and did something. I don't think all of them wanted to be career pirates, so if they were smart, they took the money. I know one of them got married. That was one pirate who swore that he was going to, you know, take his money and go to Europe on a little boat from Libya. I thought that sounded insane, but he wound up. I know for a fact that he wound up getting married in Mogadishu, and so I've seen a wedding photograph.
Wow, okay. All right, we're going to put a pin in that for a second. I do want to ask you, though, because they were asking for so much money, millions of dollars for your release. How was your release negotiated?
My mother had to raise money among family and friends and some of the magazines I'd worked for and some institutions in the U.S. and Germany, and she did the negotiating on the phone. So she's the heroine of this story. She actually talked on the phone to the pirates. She had some advice you know, from government officials, from the FBI. But the money had to come from the family.
And was it $20 million?
No. Oh, my God.
Oh.
No. No, that's why I spent so much time in Somalia. They hung on to that demand for almost a year. So they were sticklers about it. But it wasn't a serious demand. And the result was the final ransom was $1.6 million.
Still a large
Still
sum
quite
of money.
A lot, yeah.
What was it like when you finally were freed and had to re-enter into society?
Well, that was difficult because I had spent, so much time with essentially people who were not my friends, you know, and speaking in this stunted sort of language, a pidgin mix of English and Somali. So when I got out, I found myself really easily overwhelmed by people who meant me well, you know, who were friends and, you know, who people I loved, people who loved me. So it was a little while before I could be in the room with too many people. my body was a mess. I couldn't walk very well. But slowly, as my body got stronger, my mind got stronger too, and I could handle ordinary life a little bit better.
It sounds sort of like a post-traumatic stress disorder.
I definitely had symptoms. I think the FBI psychologist who was with me right afterwards, he wound up not diagnosing me with PTSD. But I know that I was hypervigilant when I first got out.
Okay. So going back to the wedding photo of one of your captors. Because weren't you, like, talking to one of them on Facebook?
Yeah, I've corresponded with one of them.
How? I would imagine these are the last people on Earth you want to hear from or talk to.
That's true. We're not Facebook friends.
Okay.
I've corresponded with him.
And through that, you found out that he actually did get married,
etc.
That's
right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. So what did this experience give you in terms of insight into the way pirates work and what it is that they're looking for and why they're doing what they're doing?
Well, that's important because they still claim that illegal fishing is the main reason they do what they do, but it's obviously not. So illegal fishing, which describes how piracy came about in that part of the world, is not the reason they do it anymore. There might be, on a given pirate skiff, there might be six guys, right? One guy has to run the engine. So one guy maybe has to have some maritime experience. All six of them need to be able to use a gun. So those are your proportions, you know. A fraction of a pirate gang actually needs to know what they're doing on the water. So that's one main thing I learned. And the other main thing I learned, the other important thing I learned was about religion. They are not entirely irreligious.
Okay. So you went to Somalia to better understand piracy.
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel like you got, I mean, you did sort of talk about, you know, the better understanding that you got of piracy, but did you get a better understanding of Somalia and the ills that are making it so difficult for the country to get back on its feet again?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I had a very skewed picture of Somalia once I was a hostage, but what's true, even if not every pirate is a converted fisherman, a frustrated fisherman, every pirate, every guard, everyone who works for a pirate gang needs a job. And that's one thing I went there to investigate, was how to build jobs in a chaotic place like Somalia. And there are ways. I mean, America had a phase of piracy 300 years ago, and that was also because a lot of sailors were out of work. We've managed to build a different sort of society, and that is absolutely possible in Somalia, too.
Given that you had some distance, do you empathize with the Somali situation now?
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, not everyone there is a pirate. I mean, by a long shot. It's an extreme minority. And the fact that the country is still in shambles is something that's sad. It's something that that needs to turn around. And I think slowly it will. It's a question of momentum, which, you know, whether the chaos or the order has the momentum.
Now, Somali piracy isn't in the headlines like it was before, but there are certainly a lot of other dramatic situations that, you know, just economic chaos and, mm-hmm. you know, a lack of a stable government have created for different countries. What advice would you give a reporter who is looking to go deep in on a story like that in a different situation, mm-hmm. but still facing similar dangers?
Well, I've done that, actually. First, I would say do your homework. then I would say don't take risks. I can't be too encouraging to a young reporter who wants to go and do something like that, because I know how wrong it can go. But someone came up to me a year or so ago and talked to me about going to Iraq. And I didn't encourage him. I just gave him some general advice. He went and he came back with a fantastic story.
All right. So then there is, it is possible then to obviously do this kind of work.
I think it's not just possible, but necessary. You can't just let chaos in various parts of the world, let them turn those regions of the world into unreported areas.
Given what you know now, would you have taken this assignment again?
No. The results of you know, getting kidnapped was not worth the story.
So for people who pick up your book, what is the most important thing you want them to take away from what happened to you?
Well, in part, one thing that helped me get through was learning how to forgive my guards. So that doesn't excuse what they did, but being able to not hold a grudge against them every day, every morning when I woke up, and finding a way to rearrange my own mind in order to stop that temptation to basically pick up a weapon was crucial. It was important, and it's the only reason I'm alive.
Was there any kind of a technique or something that you were doing to help you turn that corner?
Yoga helped, but the more important thing was a conscious decision to forgive.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Jenna Flanagan, and I've been speaking with Michael Scott Moore as he discusses his memoir, The Desert and the Sea, published by HarperCollins.